Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, should the tax code reward parenthood or punish having too many kids? We will talk to Raihan Salam today about his proposal for bigger tax breaks for parents that he wrote up in Slate, getting massive response online, including on our Facebook page. You can go there and read what people are writing and comment yourself right now. We'll talk to Raihan a little later in the show. But first, if you're really, really rich and politically opinionated, good news. The amount of money you can spend in support of candidates for federal office just went up from about $123,000 per election cycle to a new number, something around infinity, $13 million for political action committees, and some glacial number we haven't actually calculated for individual candidates. Thank you, Supreme Court. So let's talk about not just the eternal Supreme Court debate, Citizens United and all that, which got this new wrinkle yesterday, campaign funding as free speech versus a few rich people drowning out everyone else's speech, but what this might actually mean for political outcomes. Nicholas Confessori covers money and politics for the New York Times and has their story on this today. Hi, Nick. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. How are you?
The Supreme Court seems to give you something significant to write about every so often on this topic, huh?
It sure does. It sure does.
And just to clarify, what the court threw out here was any limit at all on the amount an individual can donate to all federal candidates combined each election cycle. But there is still a limit on how much they can give to each candidate for each race. So what changes in practical terms?
Well, imagine this. If you're a wealthy donor, you want to contribute money, you can give $5,200 in this election cycle, 2014, to a candidate. But because there had previously been something called the aggregate cap in place, you could only give that maximum contribution to about 8 or 9 candidates before hitting that max. So really, you can only give around $40,000 total around the country to candidates. What's happened now is that the cap is gone. You can give that maximum $5,200 contribution to every candidate in the country. You can give $5,000 to every political action committee in the country. So you've gotten rid of the cap, and if you have the money, you can inject now millions of dollars into candidates and parties and PACs, as well as super PACs, which, of course, can take as much money as they want.
Will the decision immediately affect this year's midterm elections?
I think it will. It remains to be seen how quickly the Federal Election Commission will move to create rules that conform to this decision. But I suspect that we'll see campaign lawyers and party leaders on both sides of the aisle create these big kind of joint fundraising committees or super joint fundraising committees, as they'll probably be called. And what these committees will do is this: let's say you're Nancy Pelosi and you, being the top Democrat in the House, have access to big donors. You can go to one of these donors and say, all right, I want you to write me a check for $2.5 million because I have 400 or so candidates and a party committee that can take that money and spread it around. So it puts party leaders and people with access to big donors back in the business of soliciting these huge, huge contributions, which they've basically been out of the business of asking for since McCain-Feingold.
Listeners, any reaction to the latest Supreme Court ruling on campaign finance, 212-433-WNYC? Any predictions about how this will play out? You know, these can be straight, earnest predictions. These could be your absurdist fantasies of where this is all going to lead our politics. 212-433-9692 for Nicholas Confessori, who covers money and politics for the New York Times. 212-433-9692 or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We'll read good comments from there. This is generally favored by Republicans and conservatives, generally disdained by liberals and Democrats. But our first caller, I think, is a self-identified liberal who likes this. So let's hear from Roy on Roosevelt Island. Roy, thank you for calling. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, when you look at the headline, it looks, oh boy, there, the rich are taking over America again. But I read further into the news analysis in the Times, and there is a glimmer of hope in this, in that under the super PACs, people could were pouring millions anyway, but could do it under a cloak of anonymity. And now they have to, under the rules of disclosure by candidates, the candidates and the parties have to let people know who is giving the money. The money is going to be was given anyway. Nothing has changed. These rich people were still giving a lot of money to whatever party they were wanted to support for the super PACs. Now they have to disclose individually who they're giving to and who they are.
It's a great couple of points, Roy, and it's a central question, Nick, about the practical implications of this ruling. If we were already living in the Citizens United era, which had unleashed unlimited spending by the Koch brothers or George Soros or pick your person, if they chose to, through the so-called independent expenditures, not donating directly to the campaigns, but buying massive amounts of advertising themselves in support of the campaigns, if they were already allowed to do that, and they could often do that anonymously, if this actually gives them incentive to put more money back into the actual candidates' pockets and the actual parties' pockets, they have to disclose that money more than they do the independent expenditures. And so maybe there's a liberal argument that this is actually, by a hair, a good thing.
Okay, let's unpack a few of these things for a second because it's a little bit tangled. So imagine that there are basically three ways to contribute money in American politics right now. You can make what are called hard dollar contributions to campaigns, candidates, PACs, and parties.
That's what this ruling is about.
You can make super PAC contributions to super PACs, which do actually disclose.
Okay.
Or you can make large contributions to political nonprofit groups that claim to be running issue ads and not election ads for the most part.
Citizens
United. And those contributions are not disclosed. So what we've seen really is a rise in the super PACs on the one hand and the political nonprofits on the other as these venues for these huge checks. I do not believe that this decision from yesterday is going to take money, you know, kind of out of those two categories. I think it's going to add new money to the first category. It makes it easier to pour large checks directly into the candidates and the parties instead of having to pour the money into these outside groups that could already take some more money. And, of course, the upside here obviously is that, yes, this added money into the party and candidate system is all going to flow through entities that have to disclose their contributions. So for those who care about disclosure, there's certainly a ray of hope in this decision in the sense that the new money is not going to flow into these secretive political nonprofits.
And in practical terms, I would also ask, disclose to whom? Who matters? If you're giving a lot of money to a candidate, and let's say you're an oil tycoon, and somewhere on a piece of paper you have to write down, I'm Joe Blow from Joe Blow Oil giving this money, that doesn't mean the public's going to know that when the candidate buys their advertising that just goes up on television and says, paid for by Smith for President, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, we have seen some moves for tighter advertising disclosure from the Federal Communications Commission. But it's true, for the most part, there is a lot of political speech out there, a lot of advertising. It flies fast and furious, especially a bit later in the election cycle, and it is often very hard to say who is behind what. And, of course, the real problem there, I think, is these political nonprofits, you know, people who want to spend money secretly in politics rely heavily on these political nonprofits. If you want to elect somebody or unelect somebody and don't want anyone to know that you're involved at all, what you do is put the money into a political nonprofit. So even as the Supreme Court is making new rules about campaign donations, we have a parallel fight in Congress and elsewhere over disclosure for these 501c4 groups, as they're called, these political nonprofits. And truly, the real battle for disclosure is going to be fought with these political nonprofits.
Nicholas Confessori from the New York Times covers money and politics as we talk about the Supreme Court ruling yesterday, lifting the cap on total aggregate donations by individuals to all federal candidates combined. And Jason in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jason.
Hi, I have a question regarding how long this has really been in the works. My understanding is that this was all kind of came together of really beginning with Nixon and post-Nixon with Gerald Ford signing the legislation aimed at purging money in politics. And pretty much there were a lot of people in his cabinet, from what I understand, including his chief of staff, Rumsfeld, and then later Cheney, who actually fought against trying to get those provisions continued. And it's kind of been a campaign for a couple of decades to overturn those laws. Is that correct, or how long has this really been going on,
Nick,
this battle?
Is that where you'd start the history, Watergate?
Well, you know, a way to kind of understand this is to start with Watergate, which really exposed the maximum danger possible with what had been a widespread system of secret money. There was no disclosure, there was no reporting, there were no limits. After Watergate, after the scandal, Congress passed a series of reforms, and some of them were modified after court rulings, especially one called Buckley v. Leo, and it sort of changed everything for American campaign finance. What we've seen since then is really a steady shrinking of the Watergate reforms. Pieces of the reform puzzle being knocked out one by one. You know, the Citizens United decision was obviously a big one in 2010. It said that, well, as long as you spend and raise the money independent of the candidate, corporations can spend money, and so can unions, kind of directly on election ads, right? What we see here now is another one. The aggregate contribution limit also dates back to the post-era. And what we're seeing is bit by bit, right, all of these reforms are being shrunk, and the court is adopting an ever more stringent set of rules for when it's okay to restrict campaign money.
So Chief Justice Roberts wrote in his majority opinion that, quote, the government may no more restrict how many candidates or causes a donor may support than it may tell a newspaper how many candidates it may endorse. Is that infuriating you as a newspaper man, that analogy?
Well, I don't work much for the editorial page, right? It's certainly a key point that defenders of this decision often, you know, compare a newspaper and say that the speech contained in a newspaper or an editorial page is no different from the political speech of a campaign ad. Now, I think there is a difference, but I recognize that from a constitutional perspective, right? There's a certain sense.
Oops, did we lose Nick? Nick, I think your line is coming and going. I mean, in theory, if the Sulzberger family wanted to own not just the New York Times, but go out and buy a little community newspaper in every congressional district in the country and set up an editorial page, they could do that with their money, and they wouldn't be challenged in the same way, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, look, there's with the media, again, it's always wrapped up in these issues of freedom of speech and what counts as political speech. And in fact, you saw in Citizens United, you saw a nonprofit corporation producing a movie about Hillary Clinton, and you know, one of the analogies drawn there was like, how is this different from any kind of newspaper story, for example?
Why do Republicans and conservatives like this ruling more than Democrats and liberals? Is that evidence that there is just more conservative money in politics than there is liberal money? Because some people make an easy analogy here and say, this enables the Koch brothers, but it also enables George Soros. They both have this, each side. And yet it always seems to be the Republicans and conservatives who like rulings like this and the liberals and the Democrats who disdain them. Is that just because of being rubbed the wrong way ideologically, or is there a real interest here that just when you unleash maximum amounts of money, those who are going to be the deepest pocketed individuals and corporations, they just tend to be Republicans?
Well, you know, I don't know about that, Brian. I mean, at different points in history, you know, even over the last 20 years, each party has been able to play the game at different times in a superior way to the other party, right? So in the 90s, when party officials could last raise these big contributions, the Democrats excelled at raising soft money into political parties. Bill Clinton excelled at it. You know, in 2004, it was liberals who pulled together big bucks for outside spending groups to beat George Bush. In 2010 and 2012, it was mostly Republicans and conservatives who could muster those dollars. I'm not sure
you did skip over 2008, and I think we should note that Barack Obama voluntarily walked out of the voluntary campaign spending limits and public matching fund system because he realized he could raise so much more money than John McCain.
That's correct. I mean, President Obama was the most successful political fundraiser in history. So it kind of goes against the notion that either party has an inherent advantage. But again, you know, what we've dealt with so far is a world in which you can either make you know, relatively small donation, right, to a candidate, or a huge donation to an outside group or a political nonprofit. We don't yet know what the post-McCutcheon world looks like, where you can tap into the world of people who are not super, super wealthy, but who are liquid enough to write $100,000 of political checks. And that's a class of person that is different from the class of billionaire that tends to be the biggest players in the super PACs. So we just don't know. But past history would indicate that no party really has a lock on political money. But I think there were real differences of principle and belief about corruption and democracy with this issue.
McCutcheon is this decision. So when you say the post-McCutcheon era, right, this is the era after yesterday. But could you clarify what you just said? Because you're referring to a kind of middle rich group as people who could write $100,000 in political checks in a given election cycle. I mean, don't you have to be really, really rich to do that without really affecting what you're going to be able to retire on or put your kids through college with?
I think by any reasonable standard, yes, you do have to be very rich to write that check. But what you have to realize is that, you know, the universe of people who write any check at all in politics is very tiny. Maybe, the exact figure I can't remember. I think it's under 1%, or if it's more than 1%, it's a couple of percent of all Americans ever donate to anybody. So you got to imagine within that slice, it is mostly relatively affluent people who are writing checks. And in terms of how campaign fundraising kind of really works, a person who can write a $1 million check to a super PAC is a very different order of magnitude of wealth from a person who can write a $50,000 check to the Democratic National Committee and to President Obama. It's just a different class, and there are more of the second class, but of course the first class has more money. And then below that, you have the grassroots donors who can certainly add up to a lot of money in the aggregate over time if you can tap into them.
And I think Adam, calling from the Cayman Islands, might have something to say about that. Hi, Adam. You're on WNRC.
Hi. No Cayman Islands, please.
We've done that through your earlier calls, so even though it relates, yeah, it's so tempting on this particular topic, but I wasn't going there. You did.
Well, I know everyone assumes I'm a Republican or something because of that, but anyway, I'm not. I was just thinking about, you were discussing that maybe one glimmer of hope is that at least there's not anonymity in these kinds of contributions. But as I said to the screener, I think that's sort of a red herring. I think the big problem with this, I heard someone on NPR yesterday, and I can't remember who it was, but he said the thing that the First Amendment should control is not it, what it is the content of what you're saying, but what this decision does is it increases the volume at which someone can say it. And George Soros or the Koch brothers can say it a lot louder than I can. So Robert said this is about free speech and the First Amendment, but this person I heard yesterday, I thought that was a brilliant distinction to be making between the content and the volume at which you can say it. So I think, you know, at first I kind of agreed with you that maybe there's a glimmer of hope, but after I heard that, I thought, no, not really. This is a step just 100% in the wrong direction.
Adam, thank you. So picking up on that thought, Nick, it's maybe wrong to look at it in terms of liberal versus conservative. Maybe it's just all the Democratic Party rich people and all the Republican Party rich people get empowered by this. And all the poor and middle all the poor and middle class people, regardless of any politics, get disempowered.
Listen, I think in a constitutional regime in which money equals speech and is afforded the highest protection of political speech, people who have more money are privileged and people who have less of it are not. It's just how the world is going to work. It's a matter of constitutional law. You know, the money equals speech idea is fairly well settled. What's really striking, though, about the decision from the Supreme Court and of course, the 2010 one as well is, you know, alongside the idea that money is speech, there's been an idea that it is permissible for the government to limit that speech, to impose some regulation on it, if there's a proper public interest, a government interest in doing so, for example, preventing corruption or the appearance of corruption. What these two decisions have done in the last couple of years is you see the conservative justices kind of narrowing the conditions under which you can limit that speech and very carefully kind of putting the pieces together to say there are fewer and fewer circumstances and kinds of corruption or appearance of corruption in which it is okay to limit speech. And I think one thing that's raised by this decision is the possibility that Chief Justice Roberts and the majority are laying the groundwork to abolish the base contribution limits that we discussed earlier and kind of usher in a world in which you can write as big a check as you want to any candidate and forget the aggregate limit.
And if they believe that campaign spending is free speech, why not allow unlimited spending by any donor on each candidate? Did they write anything in the majority opinion yesterday that defended that particular limit as opposed to the aggregate limit that they overthrew?
Well, you know, I don't want to delve too deep into the constitutional law because I'm not a lawyer, but kind of my reading of the decision and the experts, you kind of see him not directly attack the underpinnings of the current limit on base contributions. What you see is Roberts changing the standard by which contribution limits are generally assessed. And you can imagine that in a careful way, that can be a piece of the puzzle for a future decision that under the right circumstances or timing could abolish those limits. It's a subtle thing, but this is the long game that judges on the Supreme Court often play.
Question from our website. CK from BK writes, does this ruling have potential for a change in the power dynamic within political parties? This person writes, if I'm John Boehner and I suddenly attract large contributions to the Republican Congressional Campaign Fund, I can allocate that money to keep Republican extremists or moderates in line, can I?
I think absolutely. I think that's one of the biggest outcomes of this decision, and I've written that in my analysis in today's New York Times. I think it really empowers anybody who has a close connection to the deepest pocketed donors. So who are those people? Well, it'll be some rank-and-file candidates, but by and large, it will be committee chairs on Capitol Hill. It will be the top-ranking members of Congress. It will be Speaker Boehner, House Leader Pelosi, the President, people running for President, and the chair people of the party committees. So those are the folks who have access to the donors who can write these big joint checks. And so now, you know, as your listener is saying, you have a tool if you're one of these party leaders to reward people who in your caucus are staying in line, and conversely to punish those who are stepping out of line, because you now have the power to create these joint fundraising vehicles that can send money to them if they behave, essentially.
Who's McCutcheon, by the way? This is the McCutcheon case. He's an Alabama businessman. What did he want? Why is this the McCutcheon case?
Well, every case has to have a plaintiff, a person, you know, a harmed party, so to speak. And Sean McCutcheon is a donor who worked closely with the National Committee to try this case. What he said was basically, you know, I want to give more than those kind of overall limits are going to allow me to give. I want to give more. I think the limits are unconstitutional, and he fought this case all the way to the Supreme Court.
Jackie in the East Village, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I would like to put something on the table, which is kind of twofold, in fact, that first of all, I think this needs to apply to the tax code, because if you have that much money, then you have that much extra money to put into the tax system, because I think where the focus needs to come here is back to the individual, because there would be no presidents without all the people that elect them.
Well, if we assume that rich people are paying more than poor people in taxes, then what are you proposing that we change?
Well, I'm saying that the tax code itself is broken, because all those poor people, it's about the value of their dollar, not so much what they put in monetarily in a number. So if you're, you know, within a tax bracket that's being charged 30%, then the person that's making $2 million who's being charged whatever they're being charged can buy more with their dollar because they have more. People focus too much on about the percentage and less of the value of the money. And let's face it, from the bike program here that Bloomberg put in to your next guest who's going to talk about, you know, the tax percentage, what needs to happen is Americans need to understand that it's the majority of the people that run this country. Bloomberg can't hold this city.
Right. Well, it was not a Bloomberg issue, but I take your point about, I guess, bottom line, need for a progressive income tax, because rich people can afford to pay a larger percentage of what they make in taxes and not have their lifestyles affected. But on the Supreme Court ruling yesterday, we leave it there with Nicholas Confessori, who covered it for the New York Times. Nick, thanks a lot.
Great. Thank you.
And coming up, yes, we will have that discussion about whether parents should get larger tax breaks just for being parents than they do today. Stay with us. And Housing and Urban Secretary, Housing and Urban Development Secretary Sean Donovan, too. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.